When we look at medieval Cologne, the sources available to us often conjure up images of powerful archbishops and influential men from the citizenry fighting for power in the city. I want to break up the pattern a bit recently and look at groups and elements in the city that haven't received as much attention so far. This time we are focusing mainly on the three oldest women's convents, because Cologne's ladies' convents did more than just pray. Some of them were large medieval companies. Let's see what we can find out about this straight after the intro. To get you started, the topic is quite complex. At the same time, the source situation here is also special, as with many other topics as well. Women's convents that are rich, such as the three lady convents here presented, are better preserved in historical sources than the institutions of poor women's convents. Poverty is not sustainable, a historian once told me. Unfortunately, I've forgotten who that was. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old. But until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. In Archbishop Anno's time, in the 11th century, there were already 10 monasteries for men. However, there were only 3 for women: St. Ursula, St. Mary in the capital, and St. Cecilia. Mostly only aristocratic women, no middle class ladies, from Cologne. In the case of the male convents and monasteries, the increased numbers meant that there was also room for citizens of Cologne and not just noblemen. This remained the case for a long time. Women in the Middle Ages were far removed from the rights and achievements that women enjoy today, many of which are still surprisingly recent even in the present day. Marital rape, for example, has only been a criminal offense since 1997 in Germany. Until 1977, married women in Germany still needed their husband's permission to work, a fact that may surprise many of us younger people. Anyone who is around 30 or 40 years old today may have parents for whom this regulation was still a reality. Just as a heads up before we invoke the alleged dark ages that oppressed women. The emancipation of women in Western countries is still a fragile seedling and constantly under threat from those who want to turn back the clock. Women in Cologne at the end of the High Middle Ages had generally got more freedom than at the beginning of the Middle Ages. Even unfree women no longer had any restrictions on marriage and were just as entitled to inheritance as a free woman was. A woman's social status depended on the position of her father or husband. Women were citizens if their husband was also a citizen. In business relationships, wives were equal to their husbands. But what you realize, this system is patriarchal through and through. A woman was always subordinate to a man, be it the father, the husband, or a related male guardian. And even if women could become citizens through their husbands, they were still officially excluded from the political life of the city. Unofficially, of course, the wife of a mayor or a rich ministerial or juror had her ways and means of helping to shape political decisions, something that we can always observe in the course of history. A field, however, where women could act, albeit often not completely independently, but they were able to act as independently as possible, these were the women's convents in Cologne. Here, we take a look at the three oldest: St. Cecilia, St. Ursula, and St. Mary in the capital. St. Cecilien, or in English St. Cecilia, near the Neumarkt, is the oldest women's convent in Cologne. The question of when it was founded is not entirely clear. What is certain is that it can be traced back to the Viking invasion of Cologne in 881 at the latest. Compared to other women's convents, however, it was more modestly equipped. If you walk around Cecilia's church today, where the Schnütke Museum, the medieval art museum, is located nowadays, it is hard to believe that 15 women only lived here at the peak of the period we are discussing here, up to around 1300. Time and again, the archbishop had to help the convent with allocations. This was maybe one of the reasons why it was dissolved already in this form in 1475 and replaced by the establishment of an Augustinian female convent. Nevertheless, until 1475, St. Cecilia was particularly strict that only noble ladies were allowed to enter. There was also a convent school for the education of new canonesses or to teach the children of the canonesses. What a word, really. Because, here's a reminder for you, a canoness is not a nun. A canoness was allowed to have worldly possessions and did not take a strict Benedictine vow, which included poverty and chastity. So if a canoness was a widow and had previously had children, she sometimes took them with her. If a lady of the convent wanted to remarry or marry for the first time, she could simply leave the convent. She was not bound to it forever like a nun in a monastery. And unlike a monastery, the lady convents in Cologne were not located in remote places, but in the middle of the walled city, sometimes even in the middle of the hustle and bustle of the city's largest square, as in this case, the Neumarkt Square. Like most convents in Cologne in the Middle Ages and early modern period, St. Cecilia was connected by a typical double church ensemble, both spatially and organizationally. The directly neighboring parish church of St. Peter was also served by the ladies' convent in a certain context. For example, the ladies from St. Cecilia employed a teacher who then ran the parish school in the parish church of St. Peter. Incidentally, this example of St. Cecilia and St. Peter is the only visible sign of this one so common constellation in Cologne. Everywhere else in Cologne, this double church system was demolished, in the form of one of the two being demolished, but not here near the Neumarkt Square. High holidays were celebrated here that were important for the convent. St. Cecilia was commemorated on her feast day on 22nd November. Processions were held in alternation with the neighboring parish church of St. Peter, above all on Palm Sunday, Candlemas, Ascension Day, and Pentecost. From the middle of the 13th century, the Catholic Church also introduced Corpus Christi as a new festival, which was also celebrated in a procession first in St. Ursula and then shortly afterwards in St. Peter as well. In addition to the relics of its namesake, St. Cecilia was particularly proud of the relics of St. Evagrius, who was Bishop of Cologne in the late 6th century. Their relics were proudly presented at such processions, hoping for help from God through their intercession. Even though St. Cecilia was probably the most modest of the three large old lady convents in Cologne, they still had property. But it's a real patchwork of places, 80% of which I've never heard of. You would feel the same way, I guess. Especially individual meadows or buildings in the area around Cologne from which they received taxes on the yields, tithes or rent. We'll go into more detail about this later. In Cologne itself, they had a bakery. The convent had a bakery and their own brewery. However, this was not for commercial purposes, but for their own use. Well, you have to enjoy life in somewhere. There were also residential buildings for the canonesses on the grounds of St. Cecilia's convent. In some cases, however, there were also residential buildings for the canonesses that were located outside the grounds, but close to the convent. Despite its small size, St. Cecilia was prestigious simply because of its old age. At Christmas, the second Mass was celebrated here by the Archbishop of Cologne directly after St. Mary in the capital. This emphasizes the high prestige status of this old convent. The convent of St. Ursula is also several hundred years old at the time we are now in the 13th century. However, the name Ursula as the leader of the Holy Virgins only emerged in the 16th century. Before that, it was simply called the Ladies' Convent of the Holy Virgins. From a modern perspective, this original Cologne convent is actually of Düsseldorf origin. Oh my. Even though Düsseldorf did not even exist in the 10th century, in 922, the Archbishop of Cologne had a convent moved from Gerresheim, now a district in the east of today's Düsseldorf, to St. Ursula in Cologne. The site in Gerresheim had previously been devastated by marauding Hungarians. The existing convent of St. Ursula had probably been empty or barely inhabited for some time. A man's convent may have been present here previously, however, these were also driven out by the Viking raid in 881. But we do not exactly know what happened at that time before. However, the site still must have been in good shape and available so that the ladies from Gerresheim could easily restart here. In the Middle Ages, St. Ursula's was home to 40 noble canonesses and countless lay canonesses, those who did simple work. The location of the convent made it incredibly prestigious. In the middle of a former Roman burial ground, it was thought, without malicious intent really, that the bones of the 11,000 virgins led by St. Ursula in late antiquity were located here. This made the convent extremely attractive to candidates from the nobility from near and far, and yet, and this also surprises me, St. Ursula's convent was often on shaky economic grounds and needed financial support from the archbishop in its early period. At the same time, and this often fades into the background due to the shrine of the three holy kings in Cologne Cathedral, this ladies' convent of St. Ursula was also a major important pilgrimage center for Europe, and this also earned a lot of money for them. For the history of the building, please refer to the corresponding older episodes. For a long time, however, the abbesses, who were always noble, were not completely independent here. For a long time, the Archbishop of Cologne decided directly who became abbess here, which was a powerful office in Cologne. The convent skillfully managed to establish the cult of the 11,000 martyrs in the then-known Christian world. From the 13th century onwards, the canonesses, with their powerful abbess, were able to govern themselves now, largely autonomously, even in secular matters. What did the convent of St. Ursula own? When it was founded in the 10th century, it already owned estates in Boppard on the Middle Rhine. A church and a farm in Longerich, now a district in the north of Cologne, were also owned by St. Ursula. The North Rhine convent book lists many more estates, too many to name them all, 50 places on the Middle Rhine alone, parish churches in the entire Cologne area and around the Middle Rhine. What exactly that meant? That they, the convent, received levies in the form of money or goods from these properties, or share of it, or through lease fees for the respective properties or rights. For example, there were residential buildings on the grounds of the convent here in Cologne for St. Ursula. Initially occupied entirely by the ladies of the convent as residential accommodation, they were later also leased to other external parties in order to generate additional income. The ladies in the convent chose their abbess for life. The abbess initially administered the property, but in the course of the late Middle Ages, as the property grew of the convent, the ladies of the convent also acquired their own property to be administered and managed, which were not under the control of the abbess alone. It is not yet easy to say where the abbesses came from in the 13th century, but the various abbesses known to us shed some lights on this. Abbess Elizabeth from the Rennenberg family from 1239 to 1262, for example, was a noble family based on the Middle Rhine near Linz. Another soon-to-be well-known noble family name that we would hear in the podcast is that of Westerburg. Elisabeth of Westerburg presided over the convent from 1282 to 1298, being the sister of the then Archbishop of Cologne. In the course of the 13th century, the ladies of St. Ursula's probably became very good friends with the young Dominican order in the city, to which our Albertus Magnus also belonged. From 1296, there is evidence that the convent was accepted into the prayer community of the Cologne Dominicans, and this only happened between convents that got on well with each other. This meant that from then on, the Dominican monks in Cologne prayed for the deceased of the Ursula convent. It was only later that we learned when it was possible to enter the convent as a nobleman. In 1398, the Archbishop of Cologne stipulated that you had to be at least 7 years old. Unfortunately, I don't know whether this meant that younger girls were also accepted before then. In order to prepare the young girls for their spiritual tasks, there was an integrated convent school, as was the case with most convents and monasteries. There, the future canonists learned everything they needed for their future vocation up to the age of 15. The adult canonists themselves acted as teachers as well, for example, in the parish church of St. Maria Ablas, which belonged to them, where they taught the boys in the parish school just a few blocks away from the convent. It was also not until the late Middle Ages that we learned where the ladies of the convent usually came from, mostly from the Rhineland and Westphalia. For the canonesses of St. Ursula, as for the entire city, the 21st of October was always a big day. This is the feast day of the 11,000 virgins. On this day, all of Cologne's convents and monasteries make a solemn procession to St. Ursula's church to commemorate the city's patron saints. Somewhat more modest, but no less important, is the procession on Palm Sunday, which the canonesses of St. Ursula go through their own district. Other feast days are also on the program during the year, such as petition processions, choir, and church consecration festivals. Of course, I'm careful not to make a kind of ranking of women's convents here, but St. Maria im Kapitol, or in English, St. Mary in the Capitol, the third in this group, is really on top. The convent, once founded by Abbess Ida in the middle of the 11th century, was incredibly rich. But the history of that place goes even further back. Before that, Plectrudis, the wife of the Frankish Hausmeier, Pepin of Herstal, had already had a church built in the 8th century in the former Roman temple complex. Both ladies, Plectrudis from the 8th century and Abbess Ida from the 11th century, lie prominently to this day in their sarcophagi in the nave of the church. I can only recommend you going there if you are ever in Cologne. St. Mary in the Capitol became important primarily through numerous donations and processions. Supported by high aristocratic families, patrician families, and later the wealthy upper class of Cologne's citizens. It was the most important church in Cologne after Cologne Cathedral. From the 13th century onwards, it benefited from the fact that the cathedral was regarded as a church of the archbishop, and then also of that of the aristocratic, noble cathedral chapter. The citizens of Cologne, on the other hand, chose a different church for their own self-presentation, as many merchants also lived in the immediate vicinity of the large convent on Heumarkt. St. Mary in the Capitol quickly became the church of Cologne's citizens. Here too I would like to refer you to the episode about Abbess Ida regarding the building history of the convent. It is episode 43. St. Mary in the Capitol also owed its high status to its great age, which, depending on the interpretation, dates back to the 8th century or even to late antiquity. With patrons in the 11th century from the noble family of the Itzonitz, such as Abbess Ida and Archbishop Hermann, who were related to the Ottonian dynasty, and the fact that the Pope himself came to Cologne to consecrate the altar of the church, yes, that did something to the self-image of the canonists living here. For a long time in the Middle Ages, it was customary for the Roman-German king to come directly to Cologne after his coronation in Aachen. The first church he visited in Cologne was not the cathedral, it was St. Mary in the Capitol. The abbess of St. Mary in the Capitol was also considered the most venerable abbess in the entire Archbishopric of Cologne. Around 34 canonesses and lay sisters and servants worked here. As already mentioned, St. Mary in the Capitol became the main church of the Cologne citizens. On Epiphany, on 6th January, the Cologne City Council marched in procession from the town hall to St. Mary in the Capitol. Only then did they go to the cathedral. When mayors of the council of the city of Cologne died, I know I'm getting ahead of myself here chronologically, St. Mary in the Capitol was a preferred church for funeral services. Economically, dear people, it was a really strong and rich convent, even well into the early modern period. What was it all about? Dear people, the North Rhine convent book always tries to be as brief as possible. in bullet points and abbreviations. And yet the list here is several pages long concerning St. Mary in the capital. Countless farms, vineyards, estates, rights to taxes and levies here and there in places you have never heard of, which were subject to tribute or levies to the convent. There were so many of them in the Rhineland and far beyond that even the convent made a hierarchy within all these possessions. So if you had a bunch of farms in one area, one farm was administratively higher up in the hierarchy, which then supervised the neighboring farms. Sounds complicated? Yes. It was in the Middle Ages too. Typical for the course of the Middle Ages, a system of hereditary tenancy was introduced and local farmers were given the greatest possible freedom by that. The convent was also active in trade, as it owned many vineyards. It was logical to sell the wine produced here. Really, folks, the list of possessions just doesn't end. Let's not even try. Just believe me, the convent was incredibly rich due to its important position and the donations that came with it. And as the church of the citizens of Cologne, the convent owed a lot of its income to so-called memorial foundations. What does that mean? Rich citizens, mayors, jurors, ministers, ministerials, members of the Riecherzeche, members of the patricians, donated money to the convent for the memory of their deceased. In return, the ladies of the convent prayed for the immortal soul of the deceased. And no, this was not invented by the evil church, but was a ritual that can be observed in this form in many cultures, even in ancient times, in pagan religions. It probably developed from this and from Judaism into Christianity. Of course, St. Mary in the capital also had a school. In the legend of Hermann Josef, he goes to school right here in St. Mary in the capital. It also had a hospital, its own bakery, and, as it was also an important place of pilgrimage, a cemetery, the so-called Lichhof. The latter was used for those who died on pilgrimage to Cologne or in the hospital of St. Mary in the capital. I mean, you have to consider some people are on pilgrimage for weeks or months, and maybe they are not as fit as they should be for such a journey, and the possibility to die on your pilgrimage, it's possible. Today's cruise ship also have places where they store dead passengers who died on the trip. Of course, there was also a lot going on here on public holidays. At Christmas, St. Mary in the capital was the first church in which the Archbishop held the first Mass, not Cologne Cathedral, and this visible sign emphasized the highest status that this convent had within the Cologne Church. Of course, feast days in honor of Mary and in honor of the founders Plectrudis and Ida were also going on as well. Whew, I have to say my head is spinning now. Time for a short last break. What do you perhaps notice? As far as everyday life and so on is concerned, it's difficult to break it down exactly to these locations, or that of individual biographies and fates. That's the problem with the availability of historical sources. Many things remain elusive. What is a normal daily life looking? How does it look? I mean, if anyone out there has something to share with me, with knowledge, I would be grateful to learn more. That's the problem of me having to publish an episode every 3 weeks. Sometimes I just lack the time to study or learn more. And what is also striking, I have always tried to tell you how many ladies lived a largely spiritual life here. If you do the maths, the three oldest ladies' convents might have around 70 to 100 places. Places that were usually only reserved for noble ladies. So even the richest citizen of Cologne, female richest citizen of Cologne, had virtually nearly no access to them. However, religious self-realization was a goal pursued by quite a few women in that time. Whether out of piety or the desire not to end up as a wife, given that the population of Cologne in the 13th century was around 40,000, this clearly shows that the demand was greater than the supply. So what was a woman to do if she wanted to lead a celibate religious life but could not gain access to the noble ladies' convents? From the 13th century onwards, another life model came into question for them, that of the beguines, women usually living in small communities who dedicated themselves to celibacy and property, lived in shed flats in the center of the city and were in great demand by the normal population. Cologne would become one of the hotspots of the beguine movement, which was largely outside the official church, one of the great religious lay movements of the Middle Ages. But, people, we'll have to dedicate a whole separate episode to that. We'll postpone it. So, let's end this episode for now. I hope you enjoyed the insight. The three oldest ladies' convents in Cologne, St. Cecilia, St. Ursula, and St. Mary in the capital, were therefore not only religious institutions, but also important economic and social players in medieval Cologne. These convents, in which mainly noble women lived, had extensive possessions and influence. They administered estates, owned numerous different properties, and also carried out economic activities such as agriculture, wine, and trade. The role of women in these convents was special. They were not bound by a clear vow like nuns and could marry or leave the convent if necessary. This possibility offered women a certain degree of autonomy in a thoroughly patriarchal society, even if they were still under the guardianship of male relatives or even the archbishop. However, the life of a canonicess was not accessible to all women. Due to the limited space and high social demands, only a few women were able to follow this religious way of life, which led to a demand for alternative life models such as the beguines. The beguine movement, which established itself in Cologne as one of the central ones in medieval cities, offered women a way to live religiously and without marriage, but outside the strict hierarchy of traditional convents and monasteries. As I said, we'll come to that another time. Overall, an examination of the ladies' convents showed that women in the Middle Ages were able to exercise a certain degree of influence and self-determination despite many restrictions in certain areas, such as here. The ladies' convents, as central institutions in urban and religious life, offered a space for religious fulfillment, prosperity, and a certain form of social and economical power for women, which is sometimes overlooked today, and also possessed power within the Cologne Church. Well, thank you this time to Doris, Marion, Norbert, Antje, Christian, Axel, Jos, Sylvia, and Michelle for your tips via PayPal. Almost 90% of the literature I used was the so-called Nordrheinisches Klosterbuch, so North Rhenish Monastery Book, Volume 3, which deals exclusively with Cologne and was published only in 2022. The volume is practically a thick printed database on all of Cologne's convents and monasteries from the Middle Ages to the 19th century. A great reference work. You won't find this information in it anywhere else, especially not on the internet. I was also helped by Leta Böhringer's account of spiritual communities for women in medieval Cologne, she wrote that in German of course, from the Libelli Rhenani series of the Archbishop's Diocese. Diocesan and Cathedral Library of Cologne. Many thanks at this point to the library for the quick and uncomplicated delivery of that. As always, the classic, Köln im Hochmittelalter, so Cologne in the High Middle Ages by Karl Dietmar and Hugo Stehkämper. Yeah. And with that, thank you very much for listening. Rate this podcast in your favorite podcast app, and as always, auf Wiedersehen.